culture.
Sam Elliott and his epic mustache often reminds us that beef is for dinner. And why not? Juicy, succulent, delicious. What's not to love about these beloved bovine? But what about having cow continuously for over a year? Say, hundreds of pounds of prime chuck and shank. One man hopes to answer that question, and that man is our guest today, Mr. Jared Stone, Emmy-winning television producer, author of the new book, Year of the Cow, How 420 Pounds of Beef Built a Better Life for One American Family. It's the saga of how one man packed a quarter ton of red black Angus cross steer into his Prius and then into his home freezer, spending an entire year cooking his way through the frozen carcass, learning much about the meat industry works, how it doesn't work, how it obfuscates, and how life would be better if we all just ate responsibly. Jared, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Oh, sorry about that long-winded introduction, but I wanted to make a point because we were talking a little bit about before. And by the way, any chance I can get to mention Sam Elliott and his mustache? They're sort of
absolutely. It's quite a mustache.
It is a mustache, and when he doesn't have it, it feels just wrong.
Yeah, it's like so much part of his personality that if it's gone, it's like who is that guy?
Like I think him and Tom Selleck, they have a bond exactly. when they're not stealing water. But I just want to bring up because we were chatting before the recording. You were just in Lawrence, Kansas, a few weeks ago at the Raven Bookstore, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I had a reading there at the Raven.
The Raven, you know, and I know a lot of people think that the only noteworthy thing they do is hang colored bras across the bridge, but they're actually, it's true. It's true. It's for breast cancer. They, right. But it's still colored bras. It's very funny. But they're actually a pretty good bookstore because they actually carry quite a bit of obscure and out and hard to find things. And I don't know if you, I know you are, you went to KU. You went to the University of Kansas, correct?
I went to KU. Yeah, I went to the University of Kansas. What's more, I was a townie. So I grew up, I was born in Lawrence, Kansas, and I grew up there.
Oh, we could, so. we have to talk and plan later. They, you know, what's really sad because you actually wrote a book that's printed on dead trees. And right. Lawrence, for such a reading city, doesn't have very much in the way of actual bookstores anymore. So that's very unfortunate that a lot of the big chains have closed. And thank goodness for places like the Raven, and I know the Dusty Bookshelf and a few others that
right.
that actually carry real books. So
yeah, absolutely. I'm of an age that I was still sad when Adventure Bookstore closed. I don't know if you remember Adventure that was on Mass Street there for a long time. But
you were,
but yeah, it's from way back.
Like most people in Lawrence, I am a non-native who moved here years and years ago. So that's a little before my time. But one thing I do want to introduce to anybody who's just sitting here glassy-eyed listening to Jared and I talk. if you ever do get a chance to come to Lawrence, Kansas, welcome to LFK, where the F stands for fun.
Yes, yes.
And nothing else.
Not anything else. It's Lawrence Fun, Kansas. Absolutely.
Okay, we have got the niceties out of the way, so I just want to get back to the book, and I want to let everybody know that I'm a little disappointed, because 2015 is actually the year of the sheep, according to the Chinese zodiac, so your book is kind of misleading people who think it's a zodiac guide to the...
That's correct. However, when I began the process, it was actually the year of the ox.
I agree with you, because I think the year of the lamb, which is actually 2015, wouldn't sound very good.
Yeah, probably
year of the
not.
Sheep. Yeah, it wouldn't sound very good. And I think – and I want to get back to that for a second there because according to the book, it says there right in the subtitle that you had over 420 pounds of cow. And I think anybody listening out there would say, oh, my intestines, oh, my arteries clogged. But I don't think anybody would be rushing out to buy a book about 400 pounds of kale.
That's true. That's true. There would probably be I don't think you could – I think 420 pounds of kale, I don't even think you could freeze that. I don't think it'll last long enough to consume, let alone to figure out, you know, as many ways to cook kale, as kale is a rather homogenous vegetable. Like, whereas in this process, I was trying to make the absolute best use of every part of this steer that I possibly could. So, you know, figuring out the best way to, you know, what is a chuck roast anatomically? How does it behave on the animal? How does that translate to a culinary application? And, you know, what's the best way to make use of that in the kitchen? What's the most chuck roastiest chuck roast that I could possibly make? So yeah, if you were doing something with kale, you know, you would perhaps have fewer options.
I think if you were doing something with kale, you wouldn't be invited to many parties, except in Lawrence at the Merck. Ding. But going back to this, I mentioned this in my very verbose intro that the cow is actually not a cow. It's actually a steer that you actually purchased. And
that
it was
correct.
It was a red black Angus crossbreed, correct?
That is correct, yes.
So what is a red black Angus crossbreed to people who don't know their cow from their steers?
Yeah, of course. Well, a steer is a boy cow. So a boy cow that has been snipped. So that's the first thing. So most beef sold in the United States is, in fact, steer. So year of the cow is really kind of a colloquialism. It's actually a steer. And the red Angus, black Angus cross, you have to go back to Scotland for that in the 1870s. Well, a long time ago in Scotland when they were originally delineating livestock breeds, a dude named Hugh Watson realized that he was really good at breeding cattle to get the traits that he wanted to out of them. And so what he did, he did several interesting things. He bred amazing cattle that, that were big, strong, beautiful beasts. Two, he entered them in livestock competitions, which is something that wasn't done a whole heck of a lot at the time. And three, he marketed his cattle in a really interesting way. He bred all of his beautiful cattle to be completely jet black. And as a result, Watson kept winning all these livestock shows, winning and winning and winning and winning. And every animal he brought out was stone cold jet black. And they came to be known, because he was in County Angus in Scotland, it came to be known as the Black Angus breed. But the problem, of course, is that the black coloration, the gene that denotes a black coloration in Black Angus, is in fact a recessive gene. Is in fact a dominant gene. So if you have two Black Angus cattle, you can have them breed, and they could produce a non-black offspring, because they could produce a red offspring. Those red offspring are frequently as high a quality in terms of the animal as the Black Angus. It's just that they happen to be red or kind of a mousy brown. And so they call those Red Angus. And in 1950, I believe the year was, in the United States, they created the Red Angus Breeding Association and standardized that as a breed as well. So Red Angus, Black Angus cross just means it's an Angus, and its ancestors may or may not all have been stone cold jet black. That's what it means.
Now, going back to the color thing for a second there, because sure. I know, we talked about recessive genes. When a lot of people talk about, in your book, you talk a lot about native farming versus, grass-fed versus corn-fed. When the average person goes to their local butchery, and I don't think they have an abattoir or anything around in most places, and they find these big, juicy red steaks, what is the chance of that an inexpensive cut will be naturally juicy red? Or do you think – is there a tendency like they do with artificial farm fisheries where they sort of inject dye and color them to make them redder?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I know in a lot of supermarket beef, it's sometimes since mine was a very specific animal and a very specific steer that I ate over the course of those years, I can't really speak to supermarket beef as a whole in terms of the practices that they use to, for example, to change the color. I know that oxidation can have a large effect on what kind of color. So how recently it was cut. If it's cut recently, it'll have a very bright red color. If it's a little older, if it's a little grayer or bluer, then it's probably been sitting out a little bit longer. If you have something that has a little bit of a rainbow sheen on it, you probably want to avoid that, because that's not a good thing.
We like to call that manager special.
Yes, yeah. Even cheaper, it's still not worth the price.
Yes, if you're getting beef for 99 cents a pound, it's best to avoid it and leave it on the shelves.
Yes.
Now, going back to something, and I don't want to say anything that's going to get you in trouble, because you definitely have written a very readable book that would make a fantastic set piece on some sort of daytime soap opera drivel like The View or whatnot. And we are definitely not The View, and there's no coven here. So I don't want to say anything that might bar you from ingratiating yourself with the ladies, because I think it's a fascinating book. But I want to go back real quick about this whole idea of natural versus unnatural.
Sure.
Now, coming from a very liberal city, and if you've ever been to – you've been to Lawrence and San Francisco and places like this where there's large communities of natural and organic and, farmers market, the idea is pushing that it's natural is somehow better. But I just want to go real quick. Since the 1950s, when the population of the world was about, roughly about 3 billion, so about 3 billion annoying people, and since then we've had this huge proliferation of GMOs, pesticides – and yeah, inorganics and combinations and combinants and everything. And in the last 60 or 70 years, the population has doubled to over 7 billion people, 7 billion annoying people. And It seems like with every new discovery, with every new Frankenstein-like food combination of spliced genes and all this and whatnot, and the further we get away from natural, the more we tend to be successful as a species. And the reason I want to bring this up is because there seems to be some merit away from the organic idea that maybe food production and as it relates to agriculture and animal production seems to have kept pace with human population. But the reason I bring this up is because there's actually a part of your book that I found very fascinating, and that is the section about health-related risks.
Sure.
In this country, we have a predisposition, despite the fact that it's delicious, to sort of shy away from red beef. That's what we've been told for years and years, shy away from fatty beef.
Right.
Now, I know you probably follow the science, but there's been a sort of rejiggering of science, and that maybe saturated fats aren't as bad as we've been told for the last 40 years, that it's really – The type of sugars, the type of carbohydrates. So if I'm perusing the shelves and I'm seeing this book about eating a quarter ton of cow, which sounds sure. amazing, by the way, sounds amazing, something like you see in Texas, why would I be interested? Surely this would make me a blimp and fat.
Sure, but yeah, you alluded to it a little bit there in the question, in that, yeah, there's more and more research that's coming out that's showing that that the fat that you find in nature, the fat that you find in an animal, in a pastured animal especially, or you know that you find in some sort of natural edible form, has not been correlated at all, really, with increased serum cholesterol. So people get concerned about serum, or about you know, think if I eat cholesterol, my blood cholesterol will jump, and there's been some research that's come out that show that that kind of isn't the case. The Framingham Heart Study is the famous one in Massachusetts that has shown that sort of does not happen. So yes, people, there is a whole lot more research that's showing that, you know, that sugar and especially highly refined sugar and highly refined carbohydrates are, you know, behind a host of maladies. The research is still ongoing like that. But in my personal estimation, part of the reason I took on this project was because I wanted to see what the best way that I could feed my family was. So other people's, you know, results may vary, but I wanted to see what the best way for me to feed my family. And I found that in my research, that eating food that itself ate food that it was designed for, i.e. grass-fed cattle as opposed to grain-fed cattle, whereas, you know, I don't know how deep you want me to go into the science of, or the science and industry of producing beef, but most beef in America is fed a mixture of corn and other grains because it gets it fat really fast. That's the very short answer. And grass-fed cattle instead walks around and eats the lawn. Well, the stuff that you can feed a whole bunch, you can feed a bunch of grains and corn to cattle and get the fat really fast. If people eat that grains and stuff, they can also, unfortunately, you know, pack on weight and perhaps suffer some health maladies as well. So for me, I, as a result of this project, even though I wound up eating, as you say, a quarter ton of beef almost, over the course of, you know, several years. I thought it would be 1 year. It turned out to be about 4 years. What I never expected from this process was that I would it would inspire me by eating such high quality beef. It would show how much other crap I ate that was certainly not high quality. It paled in comparison to how good this particular beef that I'd given so much thought and research into and made what I think was a correct choice for my family. Then when I'm doing that, you know, there's all this other food in my diet that is really not good. And so as a result of this beef experiment, I wound up eating more vegetables than a vegan potluck. I wound up eating, you know, cutting out almost all dietary sugar, you know, refined sugar, you know, stuff that comes in a bag or a box. And I wound up eating a lot cleaner and actually got in arguably the best shape of my life as a result of doing this, because I stopped experiencing these, you know, these glucose peaks and valleys that I'd always, you know, that I'd historically have experienced. Yeah, I wound up having a lot more energy and feeling better as a result of it. So yes, there's a cow on the title. But you know, the changes it made to my diet go far farther than that.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the other activities that you gain knowledge of and you sort of adapt it into your lifestyle, because I know in the book you talk about things that you'd never even imagine from a giant, you know, cow or cattle in the front cover. You talk about, I know, and I was kind of laughing at it when I was reading through it. You talked about barefoot jogging. You talked about,
yeah,
straight razors and all this stuff. And I said, oh, here we go, back to nature. But,
straight razor, I wouldn't say is quite back to nature. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, as I researched and realized that cattle used to, you know, in most industrial production nowadays, they eat corn. But, you know, one iteration back in the evolution of, you know, living with and raising and eating cattle, one step back, they ate the lawn. And that was one of their big, you know, the big evolutionary advantages of having a herd of cattle is they could just roam through a field and turn grass into protein, right? And so, like you said, like one step back, how did, you know, Nike was only invented in 1964, I believe. How did we run before we had space age polymer tennis shoes? And it turns out that by and large, the best runners ran barefoot. And so I looked into that, like you said. And then, you know, one iteration back, how did we used to shave our face? Did we always use the space age green foam and, you know, and some triple bladed goo-ga that vibrates and whispers affirmations? Or, you know, how did we do one step back? And I wound up asking that question in a lot more, as you said, in a lot more places than I ever would have expected.
No, but it's a very good point, because we talk about all the problems associated. I want to go back to running for a second. I'm a runner. I'm not a marathon or anything, but I run, you know, I run, keep healthy and all this. And I've experienced what a lot of runners do. They experience shin splints. And the most common cause of shin splints is because of bad sneakers.
Right.
You know, bad sneakers is not a natural thing. You don't have to wear bad sneakers. And in the same parallel, going back to what I talked about, the mass production of food, which has allowed humanity to blossom and explode in over 7 billion people, now we've seen new things that didn't exist before. Specifically, and you talk about it in the book, is the growing scourge of type 2 diabetes. And so you might have 7 billion people, but we're feeding them, but they're eating too much, and they're eating too much processed sugar, and they're eating too much food. And the explosion of I guess they used to call it adult onset diabetes,
right,
for type 2,
right,
is that now we're seeing an explosion of 300% the amount of people affected with this, which is almost entirely preventable, which is almost through, as you say in the book, exercise and good nutrition. And I don't want to give the impression that you can keep yourself from getting type 2, but you can severely impact its ability to sort of take hold in your system if you just make healthier choices that involve healthier foods.
Right. Well, no, I mean, here's the deal is industrial agriculture has given us a lot and taken a lot away in a lot of ways. So what we have now is we have, and, you know, especially in the United States, I think we have sort of a mindset of look how much food we've produced, and man, that's amazing. We must be really successful. But, you know, and I think there's a merit to a certain extent to a quantity of food production argument. But I think more specifically, I think we have to pay attention to the quality of the food we produce. And, you know, I don't think anyone, you know, we produce just a shocking amount of, for example, F1 hybrid feed corn here in the United States. And that's partly as a function of nitrogen surplus at the end of World War II, which I detail pretty extensively in the book. But yeah, so I think the focus has been on quantity, and I think now, you know, blessedly we are focusing more, and we're turning our attention to quality. And, you know, just because we can, you know, create this gigantic amount of food, you know, should we? One of the things the industrial, you know, the green revolution, so-called in agriculture, has done is it's made a nation of specialists. So everybody has, you know, you have farmers who make corn, and they grow corn, and that's what they do, and then they trade corn into the global trade, into the, you know, global economic system, and they get back and they buy the rest of their food from the store. Whereas it used to be, once upon a time, we had a little bit more of a full spectrum. Your agricultural pursuits of a particular household or a particular farm were more full spectrum. You had animals, you had vegetables, you had corn, you had, you know, a number of other things in our diet seemed, you know, frequently reflected that. And I think there is certainly an argument to be made for this, you know, return to quality as opposed to quantity as a benchmark for success.
Absolutely. And, you know, you talked about the Green Revolution. And what's funny is that the Green Revolution could have never happened had it not been predicated by the Industrial Revolution and the Agricultural Revolution. Like, you know, particularly in the United States, we've seemed to have almost perfected the idea of food production. You know, we have created over the last 100 years, animals that didn't exist and food competence that didn't exist. And I remember I went to – I was having this conversation with a friend a few years ago, and he said – I said, you know, you should have more fruit in your – he said, oh, I eat blueberries. I was like, well, when do you eat blueberries? Oh, I eat my pancakes. And he showed me his pancakes. They're not blueberries. They say pancakes with blueberries, but the blueberries aren't blueberries. They're sugar that's been dyed to look like a blueberry.
Yeah, that's no good.
And, you know, you start doing research. You go to the healthy food section, like you said, anything in a bag or a box, healthy food choice, healthy this. It's not healthy. It's horrible for you. It's destructive, actually. In fact, it's actually worse. And, you know, there's a big push in the green industry, especially the organics, to sort of label things. And I know it's very confusing when you have people being told you must eat organic bananas, you must eat organic yogurt. But the organic label has really come to mean not what people think it means. It's because it's this labeling practice with a very downward spiral of associated like a checklist. If you know, there's no, I don't understand how anybody could say Rice Krispies is organic, for example.
Right. No, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, there's a lot of industry pressure to water down what the certified organic label means, and that's a very tricky thing.
It is.
I completely hear you. One of the things that I've since become a big fan of is, for example, my steer that I brought home was not organic. It was raised. It grew up in a fruit orchard, actually, because the entire herd. It's an interesting thing the way they produce it at the rancher I went to is they actually don't produce grass fed beef to get grass fed beef. They produce it as part of an integrated system in order to grow better olives and stone fruits, which is the craziest thing I'd ever heard at the time. I mean, it was amazing, and it was kind of a mind blowing experience. So back to your question, the way they I hear you, but one of the things you can circumvent that with is if you, and this is easier said than done in a lot of cases, but if you can establish a relationship with your farmer or with your rancher. For example, my steer wasn't organic, but I'd done all the research and I knew it was pastured, it was grass fed, grass finished. I knew how it was going to be processed and I knew how I was going to get it home, and I knew my rancher, Chris, and he and I developed a relationship, and you know, so it's kind of putting a face with your food production, because, you know, for better or for worse, one of the things that's happened here is the road from farm to table has gotten very, very long in the United States. And yes. If you can shorten that, and if you can know the guy who produced your food, if you happen to frequent a farmer's market and you buy from the same guy a lot of times and you get to know him and, you know, what his kind of deal is, that's a way to kind of cut through a lot of the is it organic, is it not organic sort of conundrums. I say this and I realize what a jerk I sound like, because, you know, that's a gigantic luxury to have, you know, to know your producer. But if you can get to know your producer, it pays dividends, both economic and health related. Or if you can grow your own, that's certainly a beautiful way to, you know, to shorten that length from field to plate, shorten that road from field to plate as much as you can. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The organic label, I mean, there's so much pressure from the industry to broaden that so that more processes come through as an organic thing. But organic in and of itself is not necessarily the end all be all. Yes. For example, if you have something with a thick skin like a banana, perhaps organic is not necessarily as important. You really have to take it on a case by case basis. My steer, for example, was not organic because they didn't have access to an organic harvester. So it was harvested in a place that was itself non-organic, and that blew the blue label or the green label organic certification, but everything else about it was far, far higher than organic. Was like they used to tout their cattle as beyond organic because it was actually for the reasons you said. You can have an organic steer if you feed it organic feed corn, which kind of defeats the purpose, because it's like saying, you know, you can, if you have organic sugar, you can eat as much as you want. No, that's not the case. It's a function of, you know, of raising the animal in an environment that is healthy for the animal and healthy for, you know, the ecosystem at large.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's going away from sort of these governmental regulations and regulatory labeling practices. And in your book, I notice every time, and just to be clear, at the end of every chapter, you have a fun recipe.
And
I do want to bring that up for a second, because I had a little trouble. I was thinking about following one of the recipes, but I had a little trouble on one of the directions. In one of the directions for braised beef, how does one whisper to meat to make it fall apart?
Basically, in a braise, what you're doing is there's connective tissue within and between the muscles of whatever piece you're cooking with, right? And so some cuts have more connective tissue and some have less connective tissue. And if it has more connective tissue, a great way to treat it is to braise it. And when you braise it, the connective tissue that is called collagen melts into a, if you cook it over low temperature in liquid for a long time, it melts from collagen into a protein called gelatin. And gelatin makes sauces thicken and makes them really unctuous and beautiful and velvety. And it's a very desirable thing in a sauce. So it turns the braising liquid into a sauce. But that connective tissue melts out of the meat and the meat falls apart. So yes, it should. Some people say it should be like butter. Other people, you know, basically if you look at it funny, it should fall apart because there's no connective tissue in there anymore. And that's why braises are so velvety and soft and delicious.
Well, I've never talked to my beef, but I will try.
Oh, you should try it. Yeah, you should totally do that.
But getting back to that for a second, in the recipes, you make a point to use kosher salt. Now, I don't know if you're Jewish or not, but I remember growing up, I lived in California for a spell, and we were in heavily populated Jewish neighborhoods, and the idea of kosher food was just a sort of a natural thing. And then you go into the local supermarkets, and you'd find all sorts of wonderful things, like kosher Coca-Cola. Wow. That actually still use real sugar as opposed to the high fructose. Oh, of course. And now there's a big push for Muslim meat, falal, I think it's called. And these meats, they're sort of – it's fantastic because these are people that are not necessarily ordained by the government as they are ordained by their respective ministries, right? And you get a quality beef, you get a quality meat that's better in some cases than the organic labeling or the companies that sort of circumvent the organic labeling. And I think the point that I'm trying to make is that I got from reading the book is that you got to do the research. You have to do your own research and you have to look at your own labels, and you can't necessarily trust sort of like the government to be your GPS to get you to the healthy status, right?
Well, one of the cool things about I agree 100%. You have to know your guy, and you have to ask questions. And one of the cool things about a lot of people who produce and who sell food, especially artisanal food or stuff that's handmade or stuff that they're personally proud of, is A, they're personally proud of it, right? So they're able to so they put a certain degree of pride into its production and presentation, and then second, they probably like to talk about it. And in my experience, they like to talk about it a lot. So you can ask those questions, and you can ask, where did this steer come from? Where was this pig raised? How are these green peppers grown? Where did this jalapeno pepper come from? I just made that up. So you can ask them these sort of questions, and you can get those answers. So if you're in a situation where you're I personally would always put a person that I've met and know and trust, or I'm in the process of learning to trust, over over a certification that may bow to industry pressure, over a certification that I don't know who made that certification, for example. I mean, organic is certainly a great guide. But you can go a step beyond it if you happen to know the guy who's making it. You've got some beautiful charcuterie places there in Lawrence, for example, that I don't know if they're organic or not. But man, they make a beautiful pâté.
Lawrence is filled with a lot of restaurants. And going to restaurants, I think this is a good time to wrap this up, because you bring up a point that I don't think anyone else, I don't care how many podcasts or how many episodes of The View you're on, no one will ever make this point that I'm going to make.
Okay.
And the future is simple. The future is a combinant of the artisanal manufacture and the food itself. And for anybody who doesn't realize where I'm going with this, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I know you've read it. Douglas Adams. The second or third book, they go to the restaurant Milloway's, I think it is. And there's beef that sells itself. Says, right. I'm delicious. How about a piece of my rump? I can't wait to serve you. That is the future. It's organic. We're talking self-service beef. There's your year of the cow that sells itself.
There you go. Well, I've never heard that postulated before, but yeah. And if you could put it in the restaurant at the end of the universe, that would be, all the better.
When in doubt, quote Douglas Adams, you'll never fail.
well, so long, and thanks for all the fish.
Oh, thank you. Touche. And for anybody listening, this has been another episode of the Pop Czar Podcast. Our guest today has been Mr. Jared Stone. We're talking about his new book, Year of the Cow, How 420 Pounds of Beef Built a Better Life for the One American Family, available now from Flatiron Books. Jared, thank you very much for showing up to the program and for putting up with my nonsense.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll see you guys next week.